You're listening to Further Faster in association with Montane, the podcast that asks ultra athletes, mountaineers, and explorers the why and the how.
Hello and welcome to Further Faster in association with Montane. My name is Daniel Nielsen and in these podcasts I speak to athletes, explorers, mountaineers and climbers to ask why they do what they do, why they put themselves through such strain. And in this special episode I speak to John Kelly. You may have heard of him recently. He's just won the Montane Spine Race, a non-stop 268 slog across the Pennines. It's generally regarded as one of the hardest endurance races in the world. And then you learn that John also finished the infamous Barclay Marathon. Watch the Netflix documentary if you haven't heard of it. And he's only the 15th person in its history to do so. So how does he do it and why? If there's something we've learned, I guess, over the last few years of making Further Faster, it's that everyone has a very, very different approach. Listen in. Okay, welcome to Further Faster. I'm here with John Kelly, who is fresh from winning this year's Spine Race. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Oh, well, when we learned about your feat and then also heard about all your other ones, yeah, we definitely had to get you on. So the Spine Race, when this had been recorded, what was it, about a week ago? A bit more, have you?
I've finished about 10 days ago, I guess.
Okay. And how are you feeling?
Pretty good, actually. Just kind of got my first physical activity since the race end, just before this. Went for a little bike ride.
Okay.
Body's mostly feeling all right, except for a bit of an ankle issue, but that doesn't bother me on the bike, fortunately.
Yes. Great. And you do a bit of, is cycling part of your training as well, or are you kind of?
Hasn't been running much for the past year. So, I mean, I had the stretch there where I was pretty serious in triathlon during the summers.
Yeah.
But over the past year, I've kind of gone full time into ultra running, and for the most part, haven't gotten out of my bike as much.
Okay. So a bit of an overview. I mean, when you look at your CV, the two things that stand out, firstly, it's winning the Spine Race, which is an incredibly hard, 268 mile race across the Pennines and in all sorts of terrible weather and in the middle of winter. And also the Barclay Marathons, which I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of, which are supposed to be one of the hardest races. What was the hardest one for you?
So I mean, it's just a different type of challenge. I've done a number of things that I've enjoyed being challenged in different ways, and mm-hmm. and so the kind of best way I've thought of summarizing it is that but Barclay pushes you closer to the edge, kind of holds you closer to the fire, but Spine holds you there for longer.
Right. Okay.
Doesn't really give you any respite in the weather, the conditions, and of course it's just a longer race for me, 87 hours versus 60 hours.
Yeah, both seem ludicrously long. So how did you go about? Well, let's go back. When did you first get into running? When was the moment that you were kind of out on the trails and you're thinking, yeah, this is my thing, this is what I want to focus on?
Well, I mean, I grew up running all around the mountains and the trails, chasing my brother as a kid.
Okay. Whereabouts was that?
Ran in East Tennessee, in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
So actually very close by to where the Barclay course is.
Right. Okay.
And so ran in high school, but then kind of took a decade off in college, and coming out of grad school said, yeah, you know, I always kind of wanted to see what I could do in longer events. I always mm-hmm. felt that I was more well suited to those. So I signed up for a marathon. I guess I was about 27, 28 at the time.
Okay. And how old are you? How old are you now?
35.
Okay. Okay.
So yeah, things just kind of snowballed from there. Kept saying, I can go a bit faster, I can go a bit farther, and then one day I learned that there are these, I I love backpacking, doing these long through hikes and yep. whatnot, and spending time on the trails and in the mountains. And one day I learned that there were these crazy people out there that actually did races on these trails. And it just seemed like the perfect confluence of interests for me to hop into that.
Yeah. And what do you, I mean, when were you always kind of sporting through college and that kind of stuff? Was it always running, or were the team sports involved, or
no?
Or so, was it just kind of like hanging out, being a college student?
So in the U.S., I assume you would still have them here as well. We have intramurals, which is just kind of teams at the college, just recreationally playing each other. So, you know, I did softball and flag football and basketball and the like, and that was kind of it. To be honest, I took my dog for jogs around the block to get her some exercise, and that was pretty much the extent of my running.
Yeah, and when you decided to kind of get back into it, you know, sort of mid to late 20s, what was it about? I mean, how much of it was it fitness that you wanted to develop? How much of it was a competitive spirit, or how much of it was just kind of wanting to be out, wanting to get outside and be outside for longer?
I really just wanted to see what I could do, to be honest. So kind of competitiveness with myself, I guess, and later on the competitiveness with others definitely sprang up when I kept doing better and better at it. But I didn't want to go through my prime and then many years later wonder what I could have done if I'd given it a shot.
Sure. So you're always pushing yourself. When did you? When was the moment you realized it's like, actually, I'm pretty good at this? did you win a race, or kind of come near the top, or was it just on a trail after a long day? Or
yeah, it was definitely kind of a gradual progression for me in terms of having better and better race results. Mm-hmm. But then in, I guess 2015, was my first attempt at Barkley, and I completed a fun run. I had time to go back out if I wanted to, and, just kind of where I was and what I was able to do from that. I felt pretty great about that result. And then later in the year, I decided to give triathlon a go, and I signed up for an Ironman and did quite well in that, and just kind of realized that the longer these things get, the better I seem to do.
Yeah. So tell us about the Barkley race. I mean, there's the well-known the documentary on Netflix, and so people are kind of increasingly aware of it. What did it always hold that kind of this mythical thing for you as well, as something that you always wanted to do, or given that you kind of grew up near the course, or
So I didn't know much about it growing up near the course. I mean, we kind of knew these people showed up in the woods to do this thing each year, but back then the race was relatively secret. And it was really when I was in college that I learned more about it, and that's when I was into hiking and backpacking, and it just I was awestruck by it, and it was always kind of in my mind as sort of, wow, that would be so awesome to do, but it'll never happen. I'll never get to the point where I could attempt something like that. It's just that there's no way. As I again gradually progressed and got better, it just one day clicked with me, maybe I should give this a shot. And it just being there, right there, next to where my family's been on a farm for 200 years, it had a great personal meaning for me. That I really wanted to do it.
And I mean, you said it kind of, just talk us through a little bit about about the race. What is it that makes it so tough? Am I right in thinking you were the 15th person to finish it in its entire history? Is that right?
Yeah, so I was the race started I think in 1986, and I'm the 15th person to ever finish,
Ludicrous.
and still the I finished in 2017, and I'm still the most recent person to
Really?
finish. No one has finished in each of the last 2 years.
And what is it about it that
So it's the conditions and the I would say unpredictable nature of it
Okay.
that are the worst. So the race is well, and then there's just simply the terrain and the physical aspect of it. The race director calls it 100 miles. It's probably more around 130 miles.
Wow.
It has about 70,000 feet of elevation gain. It is mostly off trail and unmarked, and you're not allowed to use a GPS or an altimeter or any sort of electronic navigation device. All you get is a trace of the route on a map and a compass, and that's sort of you go out there and have to follow the course. You get 60 hours to do it, which is an extremely tight time cutoff for what it is. It leaves next to no time for sleep or mistakes or anything else.
Right.
You can refuel your pack once. It's five loops, and you can stop between each loop. But otherwise, it's completely unaided. There's only even one spot spectators are allowed to be at. And then again, the unpredictability of it. So you don't even know the start time until an hour before it starts. It could start any time between midnight and noon, and then the weather. I have experienced within a 12-hour window, so on consecutive loops, I have experienced freezing conditions with sleet and frozen solid jugs of water at the tops of hills. And then within 12 hours of that, just I'm in shorts and a t-shirt and trying not to get dehydrated. I always, sorry, not completely on point with my Fahrenheit to Celsius conversions yet, but it can get into the 80s Fahrenheit the same day that you just had sleet and snow.
Ludicrous. What a ludicrous thing. I think that the entire kind of whimsical nature of the whole thing is also part of the story. It's part of the narrative, isn't it, of doing it. I mean, how did you, given that it is so unpredictable, how do you even begin to train for something like this?
So the biggest thing is preparing for the terrain. So getting all of the hill training in that you can, being prepared for that, being prepared for the navigation aspect of it. And really, I think one of the most important things is just preparing yourself to be in a bad spot. So doing things where you're likely to fail, where disaster is likely to happen, and practice kind of staying calm and executing a plan and getting out of that. So before the race, think of here are all the possible scenarios that I could encounter, and here's how I would respond to each one. So it's a ton of mental preparation, in addition to just getting yourself in the best physical shape of your life.
And what does that kind of mental preparation look like? Is it kind of a checklist in your brain, or do you write things down and say, look, when this happens, this will happen, and this has to be my response? Is that, are
Yeah,
you
I
quite
think it.
methodical about how you deal with that?
I think it varies a bit for different people, but I'm definitely quite methodical about it. I'm a data scientist, but for my day job, and so I'm quite analytical and have pretty detailed plans. But at the same time, I've learned not to make them too detailed, because if you do that, then you have to account for too many different scenarios, and if there's one little thing that doesn't go just right, then it can throw you off. So again, it's more about kind of these broad general situations, like here's what I do if I come in between loops and mm-hmm. it's nighttime and my feet are wet, and you know, do I want a nap, do I want to change clothes, what all do I want to do in that situation, so that you're not sitting around between the loop trying to figure it out and wasting valuable time.
Yeah. So and what you're doing is taking out any of that, there's a name for this, I can't remember off the top of my head, but this kind of decision about the, you know, the anxiety behind a decision and the time it takes to reach a decision, your take is one of your strategies to eliminate as many of those as possible.
Yeah, definitely. And I do have things sketched out as far as, you know, here's the weather forecast for the next loop. Mm-hmm. Here is the kit that I want to take, precisely. Here's what I want to be wearing. Here's what I want to have in my pack.
Yeah.
Here's the food I want to have with me, so that again, I'm quick and ready to go. And it's the race is, he makes, every time someone finishes, he makes it slightly harder. He wants to keep it just at that edge of possible, to where there's a 1% finish rate. And that's, you know, in response to people getting better strategies, getting better gear, getting better training.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's to the point now where you have to have things pretty well optimized. And the year I finished, the cutoff is 60 hours. I finished in 59 minutes and 59 hours and 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's just, you know, the course is divided into these sort of unmanned checkpoints. It's books out in the along the course, and you have to rip a page out of each book. And so if you think about that, that's there were 65 books, and so just like 30 seconds longer between each checkpoint and I wouldn't have finished.
Yeah.
Or 30 seconds longer per hour. If each hour of the race I had taken an hour and 30 seconds instead, wouldn't have finished.
It's ridiculous. So what you know, when you were kind of on this 60-hour journey, I mean, what were the high points, first of all? What were the moment, were there any moments of like of when you felt in your flow, when there was moments of kind of happiness, or was that, you know, is that most of the time, or, you know, are you just kind of trundling through?
So we didn't get to have a lot of that, because the race my year, it started at 1:42 a.m.
Okay,
and it started with an incredibly dense fog on the mountains, the kind that, you know, if you've got your head torch on, you stick your hand out in front of your face, and you can't hardly see your hand. And so that, plus no GPS, and we lost a lot of time in that early section. Essentially, starting out the race, you kind of know I have this amount of buffer to, mm-hmm. to make mistakes.
Right.
We basically used our entire buffer right off the bat. And so the rest of the race, one other person and myself, Gary Robbins, a Canadian, we were working to try to just stay ahead of those cutoff times pretty much the entire race. And there was never a point really where we thought, okay, we definitely have this, we're definitely going to finish. Mm-hmm. For me, not until I actually touched the finish line at the very end.
And how do you kind of deal with that uncertainty? Is it are you just kind of constantly thinking, is it just keep going? I mean, what's the mantra? Do you use a mantra? What I'm just trying to think what it looks like when you're 40 hours into this ludicrous race and you're wet and cold and had enough. What is it that just keeps you going?
So, I mean, you've got to just focus on the next thing, focus on the next climb, on the next book that you're trying to get. You know, you still want to keep that long-term goal in mind of finishing the race, but what you're actually doing has to revolve around that next climb, and just getting there as efficiently and as quickly as possible.
Right. So it's, you're breaking it down into kind of, you know, tiny moments, micro moments, when it's like, you've got one next thing to achieve, then the next thing to achieve. Does that leave you any space for this kind of overall, I guess, anxiety or kind of idea about the whole thing? Or, I mean, how do you keep those doubts at bay? Or does that do that?
It definitely helps. Mm-hmm. There are those moments. I wouldn't say it's anxiety though.
No.
So much as it is a constant pressure.
Okay.
As if you're in a race with a competitor and he's constantly 1 minute behind you. It's constantly keeping pressure on you to keep you moving forward and to keep you focused.
Yeah.
So it's important in that situation to not panic and to really turn that pressure into a positive to keep you moving.
Right. And when you got to the finish line and it was all checked off and you'd become the 15th ever person to finish the event. Was it a sense of elation? Was it relief? Was it just? I mean, this is something that doesn't often get talked about. What were the emotions like afterwards, you know, for the next hour, the next day, the next week? I mean, how do you sort of process something like that?
Yeah, so it can take a while. Right there at the finish line, for me, the biggest emotion was just relief and relaxation. I could finally let my mind drift and think about other things at that late stage in the race. My mind was so fried that it only had bandwidth to focus on one singular thing of actually getting to that finish line.
Yeah.
And so once I'm there, I'm finally able to just kind of collapse and start to process everything. And it can take a few days to really process the experience, to process what you've done and for it to actually feel real.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that happens to me when I'm sleep deprived, mm-hmm. is some people, you know, when they have the sort of lucid dreaming when they sleep where their dreams seem very real to them. I kind of have the opposite where I'm awake and it seems like a dream, and I have to keep convincing myself that no, this is actually happening. You're really doing this. You're really running the Barclay, and you're about to finish.
Yeah.
And so for me, it takes a little while just to like actually fully process that no, this did just happen.
Yeah, incredible. And then as you kind of go forward, then is it a matter of, I mean, you're the 15th person to complete the Barclay. That's just an incredible, incredible feat. Where do you go from there? Was it, I mean, what else then came on your agenda? It's like, well, I can do this. Are you constantly looking for the next hardest thing?
So for a while, that was a big thing for me, where I was just kind of, mentally wandering a bit, wondering what I could possibly do that would give me as much motivation and as much sense of achievement as completing Barclay. And I didn't really have it for a while. I had a lot of things that I was certainly quite motivated by. It wasn't exactly the same. I enjoyed taking what I had done and using that to kind of inspire and motivate others to their own Barclay-esque goals.
Right.
But it was definitely a bit of, an extreme case of the post-race, well, not the blues part, but just, an extreme case of not knowing what I should do next. And So I did have a bunch of goals and a bunch of kind of, goals in between Barclay and later things that I've finally started to discover can give me that same spark, can give me that same fire. And for me, I've found the key is really just going out and if they're not there, of making them on my own. So like this thing I did last year, when I arrived in the UK of trying to link the three classic rounds together and ride my bike between them. That's something that just really personally appealed to me. And so
that's the, so that would be the Bob Graham, the
Paddy Buckley and Charlie Ramsey.
Right. So that's from Scotland, Lake District.
And Snowdonia in Wales.
Yeah.
So it was something that, you know, I found after was just so, even though I didn't make it to the finish, was so personally gratifying. And that's a huge lesson I took away that, you know, if there's not something there that really drives my passion, just make it myself.
Right. So the idea of linking these three, these three kind of fell running classic rounds, aren't they really? And then linking them by bike. Which ones? So there were three that you were aiming for. How far did you get last year?
So I made it through Paddy Buckley and Bob Graham and got on my bike headed for Charlie Ramsey. And at that point, I'd fallen pretty behind schedule. The weather had been particularly horrific. There were some things I didn't plan well. All of this added together to me not getting much sleep. And you know, it's one thing to fight staying awake when you're out on the trail. It's a completely different one when you're riding your bike up busy Scottish mountain highways.
Yeah, for sure.
So I didn't feel safe to continue at that point.
Yeah. Will you revisit it?
So I learned a lot from that first attempt, and definitely something I'm going to give another go for.
Wow. Okay. Is that the next thing on your agenda?
Yeah, it is. I'm planning that to do sometime this summer.
Wow. Amazing. Okay. So let's talk about the spine race. When did that first kind of come onto your agenda?
That was sort of like Barkley. It's something that I found out about quite a while ago and was very personally appealing to me. I've always had this strange attraction to running in the cold and running in the dark. I don't completely know why, but it's just incredibly calm and peaceful to me.
Okay.
I don't know that you would describe the spine that way with its 60 plus mile an hour winds and rain. Still, it's something that very much appealed to me. But in my head was kind of like, well, it's in England in January. Who knows when I'll ever be able to get over and do that. Mm-hmm. But then, as you know, chance would have it, I ended up moving here and immediately signed up for the race as soon as I found out I was coming.
Amazing. So did you, this is something Jasmine Paris, who we spoke to last year, actually after her amazing race. Did you go out to win it? The way that you strategized the race, was it a clear aim to win? Yeah.
Yeah, that was very much the aim. Mm-hmm. So I from the outset was racing and using the best strategy that I felt would help me stay out in front of my competitors and get to the finish line first.
And how did that, did it kind of go through as you planned? It
did. And it was actually quite exciting, the way it went through, because I pushed out and raced from the front, right from the outset, and was constantly getting, pressured and challenged, by Ian Keith, by Eugenie, by Andre Hook, by Jason Cavill at the end, and really it was for me 250 miles of racing. I didn't find out that my nearest competitor, Jason Cavill, had dropped out until I was 7 miles from the finish.
Right.
And
okay.
He had arrived at the last checkpoint right as I departed. So for I thought that he was hot on my heels, and I was still racing
right
throughout that last section.
Okay, and so in terms of sleep and that kind of stuff, did you? I mean, you clearly planned that, and you were very. I mean, you struck me as someone who's quite disciplined against that, against your strategy.
Yeah, so I had it planned pretty well based on some of my previous experiences.
Yeah.
That was, though, it's always going to adapt a bit based on race conditions, based on how your body feels. And again, if I'm out there racing, on what my competitors are doing. So perhaps the biggest one was when I went into checkpoint 5 originally. I was planning on about an hour and a half of sleep, but I determined that the about 45 minutes was the most I could do and still get back out of the checkpoint ahead of Jason.
Right.
So I cut that planned sleep in half.
Yeah.
But it worked out pretty well.
Did it? And what? I mean, again, having spoken to Jasmine last year, you know, there are these kind of moments of hallucination or that all these kind of this dreamlike state. And did you go through the full panoply of everything of all these things that you, but there are also things that you recognized as well?
So for all of these types of things that I've done, I've really never had hallucinations.
Right.
And you know, I'll certainly see something out of the corner of my eye, see a rock or a tree and think that it's a person or something, but then I'll look over at it and say, oh no, that's a rock.
So I
don't get the hallucinations. For me, the way it really hits me is I just physically cannot keep my eyes open. And I mean, I could be liable to be going along the trail and just fall asleep on the spot as I'm moving along. So that's the big struggle for me is just actually staying awake.
Right. And then is it a matter of, you know, having a talk to yourself or grabbing a gel pack, you know, grabbing some kind of nutrition or.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes a shot of caffeine can do the trick. Sometimes you're beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes simply calories can help. The other mental tricks here and there. Certainly if I turned around and saw, you know, a competitor.
Yeah.
Like a competitor's head torch behind me, that would help.
That's going to jolt.
But really, the other thing I've learned is in that situation, if I can just lay down there beside the trail and take a 15-minute power nap, it does absolute wonders for the mind. And that can really get me going again, at least for another few hours.
Sure. And again, coming towards the finish line, knowing that you've won, I mean, it must have been, an incredible feeling. Talk us through sort of the last few moments of the.
You would think that, it's certainly been something that I've really relished in other races of that length. Mm-hmm. Is actually coming into the finish. But when I was, again, 7 miles away and I learned that Jason had to drop from the race and that my nearest competitor was over 10 hours behind me.
Yeah.
You know, the race part of the race was over at that point. My body just immediately, all these things that, you know, I had bargained with it to ignore, it kind of called in its debt. And last 7 miles, things that I had been able to ignore, things that had gone numb, were just an immense source of pain. And I wanted nothing more than to just get to that finish line.
Yeah.
And to actually be there.
God, it's fascinating, isn't it? Without that kind of imperative there, you know.
Yeah.
Forcing you along. It's just how your body reacts and how your mind reacts to that kind of, that pressure is absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, just a bit before I found out that I had that much of a lead. I had turned and just out of nowhere saw this head torch closing pretty quickly on me from behind, and I kind of thought, well, that must be Jason, and I took off all out racing again and moving at a great clip, and I keep turning around, and this guy's still closing in on me, and I think, how is this possibly happening? And eventually he inevitably runs me down, and I find it was someone that had come up to see me on the race, and you know, I immediately go from race mode to just like, okay, we're done.
He probably spurred you on. He probably did a great job.
Yeah. If he could have just, you know, stayed like 100 meters behind me, who knows? I may have finished 2 hours sooner.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. And yeah, so how do you feel now? A week later, you know, is it out of your mind? Are you still on a bit of a high or a bit of a like, you know, or do you just move on to the next thing? You know.
Yeah, so I mean, definitely looking forward to planning the next thing. It was great to get out on my bike today. I've really been itching to get back out there and do something. But for the race itself, you know, it went according to plan. I met my objective. It's one of those rare occurrences that for me, I'm really not playing the what if game with anything. I'm quite content and happy with what I went out there and was able to do on this one.
Yeah, great. Well, it is a remarkable achievement. And we watch with great interest your next crazy adventure. So yeah, do let us know when you're attacking it, or maybe after you've done it.
But
we'd love to talk to you again after that. I mean, that sounds really.
Yeah, of course.
Really pushing. Good stuff. Well, John, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Among many others that we haven't even mentioned, but you know, the Spine Race and the Barclay Marathon, just two really iconic events, and you've nailed both of them.
Thank you very much.
And there we have it. A huge thank you to John for speaking to us, and to you for listening. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll be speaking to you next month.